This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, and welcome back to New Books in German Studies, a podcast channel of the New Books Network. I'm your host, Leah Greenberg. Today, I'm delighted to be talking with Thomas O. Hawkinson about his latest book, Grotesque Visions, The Science of Berlin Dada, published this year by Bloomsbury Academic. Welcome, Tom.
Leah, thank you so much. It's really, really lovely to be here.
Yes, and it's great to hear you again after we hadn't seen each other since we were both participating, I as a doctoral student and you as an academic sponsor in the Berlin program in Berlin in 2018-2019. And I hear you've got some friends joining us today. So I guess I'll just go ahead listing off all of your wonderful accomplishments and where you are. So Tom is an associate professor in the graduate critical and visual studies program, as well as in the undergraduate critical studies program and the visual studies program at California College of the Arts in San Francisco and Oakland, California. He earned his BA at Drake University and his MA and PhD from the University of Minnesota. And his doctorate was in comparative literature. And he also has graduate level minors in German and the history of science and technology. He is the co-editor of the book series Visual Cultures and German Contexts with Bloomsbury Academic, and he is former co-editor of the book series German Visual Culture with Peter Lang, Oxford. He's also co-edited several anthologies. There are too many things to list, but I'll leave it there, and I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me about your new book today.
Oh, my pleasure. My pleasure.
So I guess we'll get started talking about this ambitious book that brings together a lot of different threads. So it talks about philosophy and critical theory, the so-called Dada art movement, the grotesque, the history of science, and the consolidation of various scientific fields in Berlin in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. So I thought you could maybe start by telling us a bit more about what your broader and clearly very diverse research program is and what your path was to this particular research project.
Yeah, happy to do it. And I hopefully my companions in the background won't jump in again to share their perspectives as well. Sometimes they're supportive of my research and sometimes they want to go outside and go for a walk. My dogs do. The research path, it's actually, my background is really interdisciplinary by design, I think, or by default, maybe is a better way to phrase it. My undergraduate work, much like yours, Leah, was in Iowa, of all places. I think we both studied in Iowa. I was at a university there and was studying economics and international relations, and sort of came to German as a kind of side interest late in my undergraduate academic career. And I think it belies the fact that a lot of my scholarship, even today, really does try to focus on two or three different fields or academic disciplines, in a sense, kind of touching in a number of areas at the same time. And that's, I can't say exactly why that's the case, although I did find when I was at Drake University and had this really fantastic course on Weimar culture with now retired Rebecca Peterson, that when we discussed photomontage in particular in the works of a rather well-known Berlin Dadaist, Hannah Höch, who was a really influential visual artist, or, and today is much discussed, I think much more so than she was during her time, perhaps. Photomontage, at least in Hannah Höch's versions, was an integration of different media sources, some photographs, photo illustrated press cutouts, paintings, drawings that she compiled together and glued together and to create her sort of fantastic comments on contemporary cultural activities in Weimar Germany in the 20s and into the 30s. And then she continued the practice until she passed in the 70s. So I think my research program is just in general very interdisciplinary. It still focuses a lot on the avant-garde because I think that particular artistic practice allows for a kind of criticality that I appreciate when I kind of think about interdisciplinary practices. Hannah Höch's work in particular sort of embodied that for me when I first came across her in this Weimar cultures class way back. I don't even want to say the year. It was many years ago, Leah, many years ago.
And what brought you then in particular? So you talked about Hannah Höch. You also focus quite a bit on a figure I was not aware of, the philosopher and poet, satirist, Salomo Friedländer. What then brought, for example, his work into your project?
Yeah, he is such an interesting figure for me. And I have to say, part of it was, you know, I stumbled across Hannah Höch by chance through the work of Maria Makkala, who at the time I was an undergraduate, was also, oddly enough, living in Des Moines with her partner, her husband, Neil Benezra, who was director of the museum in Des Moines. And Maria Makkala had written an essay about Hannah Höch's work that mentioned Friedländer in passing. And I had gotten a hold of a copy of this catalog and then started to research Friedländer a little bit and came across Timothy Benson's work. Timothy Benson, who's now at Los Angeles County Museum of Art, wrote this really wonderful text, one of the earliest studies of Raoul Hausmann in English, I think. And Timothy Benson also addresses Friedländer in greater detail. And it struck me as interesting. Friedländer, it was such an important philosophical voice for the Berlin Dada movement in particular. There were many iterations of Dada, as some folks may know. You know, it started in Switzerland and then moved Berlin, Cologne, Hanover, certainly Paris, New York saw iterations of Dada in the 1910s and 1920s. But Friedländer was such an important philosophical voice for the Berlin movement, and yet he was so marginalized, much like Hannah Höch at the time. You know, before Maria Makkala's scholarship, no one had been talking about Friedländer. And then I stumbled across his name, and then Timothy Benson sort of alerted me in Benson's scholarship to Friedländer's significance. And from there, I was sort of started to dig and just kept digging and digging and digging. And Friedländer seemed more and more important the more I dug.
And I'll take a moment now to return to the title, which is Grotesque Visions. And so I think almost more than it is about the grotesque, the book is about vision and the visual and how seeing was theorized and was developed as a sort of central feature of science in the late 19th and early 20th centuries in Germany. And so I was wondering if you could sort of outline for listeners what some of the radical shifts in thinking about vision were in the early 20th century. And it's funny that we're talking about vision on a non-visual medium.
That's true.
A bit more about the theorization, the politics, and the mobilization of vision that you talk about. And how did it change in this period?
Yeah. Well, in short, the changes were in the late 19th century that I kind of trace in the book and turning into the 20th century were around a sort of empirical scientific methods used to kind of understand how the eye operated, how the eye operates, how other forms of sensory perception actually function. So there were real efforts, and for I think a number of reasons, the late 19th century was so important for sense physiology. Certainly there were advances in science in a number of areas. And Rudolf Virchow, for example, is a key figure in the book, and he represents, sort of embodies a lot of the discourses. He was a cellular pathologist in the mid-1800s and then became more specifically focused on anatomical pathology, and then became a politician in the late 1900s or the late 1800s. So he started the Progressive Party, was a lead figure in the Progressive Party, and was a well-known political figure, but also this very active scientist. And the idea was that you needed to sort of empirically demonstrate how vision worked and try to find some sort of universal explanation for how vision in this case operated and where it was located in the mind or in the eye or somewhere in between. And those practices, both I found as I was doing research and reading a lot about the sense physiologists, Emile du Bois-Reymond, Hermann von Helmholtz, and others, you know, with colleagues at the Max Planck Institute for History of Science in Berlin, we had this reading group, and just discovering that as much as the sense physiologists during this period were trying to explain how vision worked and other senses actually worked to try to find some universal truths, we were also seeing the way in which other scientific discourses, for example, anthropology or sexual science, sexology, were also taking up visual evidence as a way to sort of prove their claims about the truth of certain human races or certain human sexual predispositions, gender orientations, gender identities. And they seem to be really kind of, if not paradoxical, then contradictory, the fact that a number of fields in sense physiology were questioning how vision could even operate as a universal truth, yet other scientific fields were saying, we're using visual evidence to demonstrate the truth of the human condition or certain human characteristics more broadly. So there was a real contradiction in there. And so a part of it is I wanted to get at that in the book project. And I looked at scholarship. Andrew Zimmerman's work on anthropology and anti-humanism in Imperial Germany was so important. H. Glenn Penny's work about objects and displays in museums of the 19th and 20th century was super influential as well. And then other people like Frederick Schwartz and Janet Ward even doing work about visual culture and scientific discourses during the same period I found really, really helpful. So just lots of contradictions in this turn toward empirical proof around the certainty of vision specifically and sense perception in general.
Yeah, and that's one phrase that recurs in your book is this idea of sehen lernen, to learn to see. And that's also tied with something that I found very interesting. You mentioned Rudolf Virchow, which is this idea, which I think also feels very timely, of how do we communicate scientific information and what are the risks and rewards of making scientific discoveries or scientific developments or knowledge legible to the public or quote unquote lay audience. So I wanted you to maybe talk more about how that's dealt with in your book and how art in particular, and in particular the grotesque, which we'll talk about more, is able to respond in this debate or this question of whether the public can be, quote unquote, trusted to engage in the ambiguities of science or as it were, the denials of the ambiguities of science.
Yeah. Well, I was seeing an interesting parallel between, like I said, there were these kind of debates happening in across various scientific fields at the time, sense physiologists in particular, thinking about sense perception, and then other scientific fields sort of taking up the senses as if they were the unquestionable vehicles of truth. And so what I really did like is when people like Virchow would set up these displays, his Institute of his Pathological Museum, for example, which still exists today in some form.
I've been to it.
Yeah, the Berlin Brandenburg Medical Historical Museum, which has a sort of interesting, somewhat conflicted history to its origins. Virchow's intent, I think, was, and I don't want to say this even because it sounds so crass, was very noble in the work he was doing. I mean, he was a cellular pathologist to start. He became more explicitly identified with anatomical pathology, and then fighting diseases and illnesses. And then a lot of his work was taken up by anthropologists, physical anthropologists in particular. He was a humanitarian in the broadest sense of the term in a way, I think. But nevertheless, some of his research did end up supporting some of the more exploitive dimensions of anthropological practice, including, you know, things like colonialism and Germany's efforts to sort of justify its colonial activities. And so there's that dimension. I mean, Karl Hagenbeck also factors in at some level here, who's notorious for sort of using and being part of some of the anthropological circles, but bringing not only captured, quote-unquote, foreign exotic animals to display in Germany and European zoos, but also people under the same auspices, that there was this sort of a need to educate the public around these kinds of things. And, you know, so Fierschau's own trajectory is a little bit, you know, tricky to navigate. And I think if you go to the Berlin Brandenburg Museum today, they do honor his work. You know, it's I was fascinated when I went the first time, Leah, and this was, gosh, I'm embarrassed to admit this, it was probably 1998 or 1999. And I was fascinated because they did have a number of jars of pickled and preserved specimens, human organs, you know, not to gross anybody out, but also, you know, various kind of fetal developments that were kind of preserved for educational purposes among the medical scientists at the Charité Museum, the Charité Hospital, but then also used in the public museum portion to help educate the public. So there was this sort of, I think Fierschau's intentions were good in educating the public, showing how morphological developments were the result of cellular problems, that, you know, a misshapen cellular reproductive practice would end up in a physically visible kind of abnormality, you know, for lack of a better term. But I think the thing that I loved about the artists that are in the study, and you know, Friedlander is a super important figure here, Henne Huch, but there's also a Dutch writer and who is not really a visual artist, but was identified with the Distill movement or the style in the Netherlands and came to Berlin, Till Bruchmann, who wrote about some of the displays in Fierschau's medical museum and other medical displays in Berlin. And just this sense that these artists like Bruchmann and Huch and Friedlander were not necessarily saying science doesn't have any validity and can't really do anything to help humanity. What they were very critical of was sort of the, what Friedlander had this beautiful phrase, the merely illusory paradise of habits. Mm-hmm. And they really wanted to engender through their artistic practice, I think, and sort of try to argue in the book, a kind of critical reception of scientific information. I think there are parallels to, you know, kind of contemporary conversations around science. And certainly this has happened before, where, you know, we question expertise and challenge expertise and see people, you know, kind of, you know, in contemporary parlance, poo-pooing vaccines, for example, even though scientists, for the most part, think they're very good things. The artists I look at aren't saying science is necessarily something to poo-poo. They're saying, let's be critical about the information and see what it's doing in the larger scope of a human betterment and human interest. So there's that element that I think is really key.
Mm-hmm. And to that end, you talk about the different tactics that these artists use, and one of the central ones sort of being the grotesque, or mm-hmm. also grotesque could be used as an adjective, but use it also as a noun. And I was wondering if you could sort of lay out, there's a lot of interesting research and different areas in which the grotesque manifests itself. So I was wondering if you could lay out what grotesque means for you in this book, mm-hmm. And sort of how it works alongside this issue of contemporary science.
Yeah. You know, the grotesque, it's such an interesting concept because it has a weird history. it's history itself. The term is sort of historically disjointed. It comes from the late 1400s. It's an Italian origin, grotteschi, grotto-like. And it was basically archaeologists in Rome, Italian archaeologists in Rome, kind of uncovering what they assumed were underground grottos that were built with these beautifully painted frescoes with, you know, elaborate metallic paints and very colorful kinds of figures that were hybrids of humans and animals and plants and animals. And they thought, you know, these are underground paintings. It's like some sort of honorific grotto. So they were called grotteschi, this particular kind of, these particular hybrid figures and forms that they discovered. But the grotto they had found was actually built in the first century Common Era and under the rule of the Emperor Nero sometime after 64 Common Era. And the way the history works, every time an emperor was dethroned in Rome, the next emperor would sort of destroy all the key buildings and then just build on top of them. So Nero's most elaborate creation was this thing called the Domus Aurea, the Golden Bath. And when Nero was deposed and fell from power, the next emperor sort of destroyed the bath and built on top of it. And some of the frescoes were preserved and then rediscovered in I think it was in the 1480s or maybe even the 1490s. And that's where the term actually comes from. So it has a kind of art historical archaeological origin, which I think is kind of interesting, especially for fans of Foucault's idea, Michel Foucault's idea of archaeology of knowledge. It's quite literally a kind of, it comes from an archaeological event, this term. But it does have such varied uses in the contemporary. And this, I mean, one can trace, you know, and I don't do this fully in the book. Other folks do this quite well in the 19th century, some of the work being done by German romantics. The idea of the grotesque is kind of a playful decorative. The arabesque is sometimes used as an interchangeable term. There is a font, and I teach at an art and design college, and I always love to talk about the font, Accidents Grotesque, which is a Swiss typeface, which was developed by folks who wanted to have clear, non-decorative displays of information that later kind of evolved into what is known as Helvetica today, which is one of the most common fonts, typefaces that we use for road signage and subway signage. And so the font, the typeface history is totally opposite of the history of the art historical concept of the grotesque, and that art historically, the grotesque becomes associated with the arabesque and the decorative and the playful and the whimsical. So there are these various permutations. And one of the, you know, things I do in the book is talk a little bit about Mikhail Bakhtin, whose work on grotesque realism is sort of well known, and who's very much interested in the human body and sort of its carnivalesque and playful forms. And then Wolfgang Kaiser, who's a fairly well-known German historian of the grotesque, who has a very different take. So what I want to do in the book, what I try to do is focus on these particular artists in Berlin, and Friedlander is the kind of key figure here and kind of coming up with a particular concept of the grotesque, and explain how they were using this amorphous term as a particular critical strategy to engage what was happening in the scientific communities and the kind of tumultuous period that is Weimar Germany.
And so sort of which direction then did Friedlander take the idea of the grotesque or the term grotesque?
Yeah. You know, it also this kind of take that Friedlander has, people like Raoul Hausmann, who's a very good friend of Friedlander, who I don't really talk a great deal about in the book because there's so much scholarship on Hausmann and justifiably so, I think, but also you know, problematically so, and that people like Hannah Hurich and maybe others don't get as much attention as they should. For Friedlander, the grotesque was a kind of synthesis. Like you couldn't, he had this kind of almost metaphysical idea of a unity of opposites. And this is something that was sort of fairly common in Dada circles. When we read and study kind of some of the Dada figures of the 1910s and 1920s, they're always talking about juxtaposition. Like there's one side of the story that's on the surface and another side of the story that's implicit and not being told and not revealed. So for Friedlander, he sort of had this idea that the things are connected, and you couldn't have one position without recognizing the other side of the equation. And that's sort of reductively speaking his theory of the grotesque, that it's sort of meant to expose, when used as an artistic strategy, the unarticulated, the present that's not really talked about, that's there, but maybe not quite visible. And so we see that in some of the work, some of the artistic works done under the banner of the grotesque. I mentioned a little bit of the notion of photomontage or photocollage that Hannah Huth worked with in particular, but this effort to expose kind of the Janus face, the both sides of things, to sort of bring to the surface kind of the unity that people like Friedlander saw in things that might otherwise seem complete opposites.
Mm-hmm. And I wanted to talk a bit more in detail now about the different tactics that these artists used in responding to contemporary science. So, for example, in your chapter focusing on Till Bruchmann, you talk about how her work responds to Freud and Magnus Hirschfeld's research on sex, and in particular the fetish. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about how she responds to that, those scientific developments and claims.
Mm-hmm. Well, the concept of the fetish for Brugman is such an interesting one because it's kind of around this time. I mean, I think the text was written in the early 1830s. I forget the exact date, or 1930s, excuse me. I think it was 32 or 33. This is right before the text is a short story. It's kind of a tale of this department store of Wohnhaus der Liebe, department store of love. And Bruchmann is sort of writing a satire of Magnus Hirschfeld's Institute of Sexual Science, and he has in which is in the Tiergarten area of Berlin. It was destroyed shortly after Brugman actually wrote this story in about, I think it was 34. The Nazis burned the institute and burned a lot of the books inside and destroyed the institute. But before it was destroyed, Hirschfeld, who had been a very public advocate, a gay man himself and very public advocate for trans issues, for non-gender conforming issues, for gay lesbian issues in Germany, and kind of problematically so. He spoke up and became sort of the spokesman at times when perhaps it was he was speaking for and over others rather than maybe helping their cause. But one of the things that he did do, and he was a student of Rudolf Virchow's, Friedlander. I'm sorry, I keep thinking of Friedlander, but Hirschfeld. And one of the things Hirschfeld did was a strategy he learned from Virchow, and that is to display to the public the scientific information to help them better understand what were the supposed quote unquote causes of non-normalcy or abnormalcy, for lack of better phrasing. So Hirschfeld had this famous Zwischenstufenband. He started at some point, I don't know how few there were, maybe 12 or 17 stages of gender sexual development in Hirschfeld's theory, and eventually expanded to thousands of different stages. You know, it was of masculine men and feminine women, and all variations in between, and also sort of related sexual orientations depending on the various stages. And so it's just sort of now it seems quite comical to think about, you know, the empirical efforts Hirschfeld was trying to do to demonstrate his theory of intermediary stages. But Brugman, saw it at the time, and it was, Hirschfeld was taken very seriously and was an important public figure. And Brugman, who was, you know, by some standard non-gender conforming herself, her and Hannah Huth were partners for a number of years, were lovers. Hannah Huth had been with Raoul Hausmann in a sort of throuple-like situation. Hausmann was married and had a daughter with his wife. When he and Hannah Huth also were engaged in a romantic relationship, were lovers. But when that ended, and Hannah Huth and Till Bruchmann became lovers, they spent a good deal of time in Berlin, including visiting Hirschfeld's institute. And Brugman was quite critical of the way in which Hirschfeld was using photography in his intermediary stages wall to demonstrate these, you know, thousands at some point, more than 1,000 different stages of intermediary development of gender, sexual orientation, identity. And she wrote the short story Wohnhaus der Liebe, sort of playing with the notion of celluloid. And it's it's a concept that has such an interesting history. If from a media studies perspective, it's a plastic. It became, you know, nitrocellulose. It became so important in early cinema for the production of what became, you know, soon became a non-viable form of film production, because the kind of filmic material that was created with nitrocellulose was extremely flammable and caused a lot of projector fires. So Friedlander is one of the things that Brueggemann plays with in the story is she calls them the celluloid kinder, children of celluloid, which sometimes we could think of as dolls, because dolls were made from a kind of plastic resin at the time, and these are very common. But also she suggests that these celluloid children, whether they be dolls or figures, projections from celluloid, from cinema, actually might be substitutes for real human subjects, both in terms of Hirschfeld's research, but also in the short story in terms of warfare. Like, we don't need to have humans fighting war anymore. We can have these celluloid kinder, these children of celluloid children, take the place of real human subjects. So there's a kind of material dimension to Brueggemann's critique in that story that I find really interesting.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Mm-hmm. And this brings up the centrality of photography throughout your book, in conjunction with this issue of vision and the centrality of a vision for these scientific movements and in the discourse around them. And so you talk in particular about how in the development of German anthropology and the consolidation of that field, that photography was of particular importance in contrast to, say, in France and Britain. I was wondering if you could tell us more about what differentiated the field of German anthropology from from that of other countries.
Yeah, it's a really good question. I have to default here a little bit to some of the really fantastic scholarship. People like Andrew Zimmermann and Anthropology and Anti-Humanism in Imperial Germany, which is a really brilliant study of the kind of different strains that are more evident, I think, in the German tradition than perhaps in the other European and North American traditions. That is a distinction between cultural anthropology and physical anthropology. And I think H. Glenn Penny also does a really good job in some of his work on the museum culture of the late 1900s and early 20th century, talking about some of those distinctions as well. So there is a real focus, and you see this almost kind of entrepreneurial aspect when you look at some of the things happening with the Berlin Society for Anthropology in some of their journals. And Gustav Fritsch is a case in point, where the anthropologists in Germany really want to demonstrate the physical difference among human subjects. And they want to do it either by bringing people to Germany, in the case of Karl Hagenbeck, who was hired in to bring, as I mentioned, I think already, human subjects into the zoos in Berlin and Hamburg and elsewhere for display. That is, human subjects not from Germany, but from outside, from other countries, mostly Africa and some from Asia, broadly speaking. So there's that element. But knowing that travel was not possible necessarily for all the anthropologists that might want to study these human differences, people like Gustav Fritsch would develop techniques and actually market camera kits that they had designed to best capture human subjects and photograph them. So their measurements in the empirical kind of sense of the empirical method would be comparable across different subjects. So if, there's some pictures of this in the book, and I think a lot of the work on Frisch and anthropology and anti-humanism does a good job of this, I think, in particular, showing some of the grid structures and the and some of the devices that were used when an anthropologist was in a particular location photographing subjects, and to try to make those photographs then viable comparative tools for evidence across geographic time, but also in geographic space, but also also kind of historical time. So we would have this artifact. And one of the things that then you see are people, and this was kind of an amazing discovery for me. There were these albums that were sold, Carl Damon in particular, he had this album he created at the bequest, at the request of the Berlin Society for Anthropology, original photographs of people from various parts of the world, sort of in a photographic album of kind of human subjects. And it's the difference between Damon's album, which is, I think, from the 1870s, and then Fritsch's techniques, which are kind of more kind of circulated in the 1890s, 1900s. You see a much more cultural take with Damon's album. It's sort of people in sort of maybe their own attire assembled in a way for the photographer to take group photos, sometimes group photos, versus Fritsch's album, which is in the 1890s, or his devices and techniques, which have, you know, metal braces to put behind people's heads, so their heads are all kept in a particular position, no matter you know, when the photograph is taken or where it's taken. So, I think those empirical elements really speak to the way in which the physical anthropological tradition in Germany became increasingly problematic, especially as we, you know, it's tough to separate that particular tradition from what happens then with the rise of National Socialism and various sort of extermination programs and racist kind of programs, racialized eugenics, and not that we should separate them, but there's that early history that I think is interesting, because some of the artists that I look at in the book are taking up some of that early history in their work and sort of being critical of it already in an interesting sort of way. Hannah Hüsch, in particular, and some of her work in this instance.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to sort of follow up on, is Hannah Hüsch works in particular with photos and photo montage. And you write that she, quote, used several tactics to destabilize the belief in scientific objectivity, unquote. So I was wondering if you could tell us a bit more about what these methods of destabilization were.
Yeah. So I think she is the figure that probably gets the most attention. So a lot of folks who, you know, the title of the book was oddly, you know, Leah, sometimes I'm really, titles are much, much easier for me than content to write. But the title, this particular title, was a long time in coming. But Hannah Hüsch is I think, if you look at the cover, I had a tough time with the cover because there are two images. One is actually, that's on the cover, is a montage piece that Hannah Hüsch did of Salomo Friedlander, and it's called The Dandy. There's another work that's inside the book that didn't get the cover image, and that's called Grotesque. And that piece by Hannah Hüsch called Grotesque is a photomontage from, I think, 1963 or 64. It's a couple of decades after the period that the book really addresses. So it didn't quite make sense to do it as the cover. But in both of those instances, and in a number for photomontages, photo collages, Hannah Hüsch is using the same kind of strategies. And basically, you know, she does a couple of things. One that's I think recognizable is that juxtaposition plays such a significant role for her. And thinking back to Friedlander and this idea of unity within diversity, the idea that there's two sides to the conversation, that it's never just a one-dimensional view. We have to take in the implicit, the invisible other side of the conversation, other side of the image, other side of the idea into consideration here. That's kind of the motivating factor in Hannah Hüsch's photo collage, photo montage work as well, that there's a juxtaposition. The cover piece, Da Dandy, which is is an interesting collection of basically female images, images of what were called the Neue Frau, the new woman in Germany of the 1920s. That's a key kind of figure for Hannah Hüdig's work, is this new woman. And I think today we think of the new woman maybe as a progressive, emancipatory, celebratory figure, but this was also a figure of derision and scorn and distrust and danger in 20s Germany. This is a figure that represented decadence and decline for many people. And so Hannah Hüdig's use of the new woman figure from photo illustrated magazines, where she cuts out images of women who kind of look like this sort of Neue Frau with the Bubikopf haircut, the kind of short haircut, and in certain kinds of attire. So there's that figure in this image. But if you take a closer look at Da Dandy, this 1919 photo collage that's on the cover of the book, there's also a silhouette of a human head that these figures sort of pasted together reveal. And that human head is actually Friedlander. So it's sort of an interesting piece because it's both an homage to Friedlander, implicit in all this kind of thinking, but also recognition of the danger that some of these figures represented in 1920s Germany. But the other layer of the juxtaposition here that I think is more difficult to kind of see is it was very common, especially in the later 20s and early 30s, when other Berlin Dadaists, John Hartfield, for example, Raoul Hausmann did this as well, were also creating photo montage pieces, but they would re-photograph their works. So basically an early version of Photoshop, where they would try to make the collage, put pieces together, and then photograph it so you couldn't tell that the image was derived from two or three or four different source materials. And Maria Makala makes this point so well in much of her work on Hannah Hüdig, that Hüdig was adamant not to re-photograph her photo collages, photo montages, because she very much wanted the evidence of hand cutting in her creations to be evident, to be very, very visible. So you don't see that, obviously, in the reproductions we get from books and online and in the internet. But if you ever have a chance to see some of Hannah Hüdig's photo collages, photo montage pieces in person, and in the Berlin Gallery, for example, the Berlinische Galerie is a fantastic source for those. If you're ever in Berlin, do take a trip. It's not so far from the Jewish Museum in Berlin, and they have a number of Hannah Hüdig's pieces there. You can see her original works and see how much the hand cutting, the original evidence of putting things together that are very obviously not originally together, is so important as another strategy for someone like Hannah Hüdig in terms of the grotesque and how it can help us be critical, because she doesn't want us to assume these things are. You know, now we're so used to these images being put together, but you can imagine in the 1920s, seeing a re-photographed piece, you sort of might have fallen into the allure of this image being, sort of this magical, creative, original image. But it was, we know, obviously, it was cut together with pieces that were then glued and re-photographed. But Hannah Hüdig didn't want to participate in any of that. She wanted the human element still very visible in her work.
Yeah, I think that's certainly also something that we think about today, the idea of smoothing over that which we create and sort of creating this aura of perfection is certainly still something we confront in terms of creating artwork or anything we produce to sort of put out into the world. So that made me also think about sort of how the different discourses and frameworks you trace, how we can connect them to contemporary issues, to where do you sort of see continuities or echoes into today from the frameworks that you discuss in your book?
Mm-hmm. Well, you made me think, Leah, of course, of deep fake videos, right? As you were talking, because I think that's there's so much anxiety right now around, there's a lot of anxiety at our contemporary moment around many things. And one of the things that maybe is not getting as much attention as it had been getting were deep fake videos, these sort of videos that folks create, where they use software and, you take images, recordings from people, and you're able to reproduce, create a video that looks authentic and real, and have this person be in the video saying all sorts of, outrageous things that the person never would have said, or doing things that person otherwise might not have done. So, the this sort of erasure of the human, or even in this case, the technical intervention with the visual is such a kind of, for me, is such a flashback to what the Dadaists were doing, and looking at those parallel streams with John Hartfield sort of photographing his collages for Biz, the Berlin Illustrierte Zeitung, re-photographing them so they look sort of smooth and clean, versus Hannah Höch in this choppy hand cut thing that she didn't want to get rid of. So making sure it's clear that there's an intervention. So certainly, deep fake videos and information, being critical of that kind of information is one strain. But, Hannah Höch, and I don't want to kind of always go back to her, but she's such an important figure in this sense. She has this series, which you may know, Leah, it's called From an Ethnographic Museum, Aus einem Ethnographischen Museum. And a number of colleagues have written about this. I mean, Christy Wall, currently among them, I think Christy was a Berlin Program Fellow a year or two ago, and is just finishing her dissertation now, that I think in great part also deals with Hannah Höch and some of her collages. The Aus einem Ethnographischen Museum series is 18 to 20 collages that Höch created between about 1918-19 and 1929-1930. And they all address at some level the ethnographic impulse in German museum culture. And what those images do in the tradition of the grotesque and this focus on juxtaposition and evidence of hand cutting that's so important and sort of revealing, the implicit within the explicit, the hidden within the visual, is that they take images of mostly German new women, the Neue Frau imagery, but also some art historical images, a little bit like things we would see from the Guerrilla Girls today, or would see maybe 20 years ago. And that is art historical images of women displayed for kind of objectification and purposes of gratuitous, kind of nudity. And juxtaposes those kinds of images with sculptures from various colonized territories, pieces that maybe were stolen and brought back to Germany, images of people in other countries that were from some of the anthropological magazines published at the time in the 1910s and 1920s. And the series From an Ethnographic Museum really tries to show, I think, how this sort of European, non-European, a white, non-white, colonial subject, colonized people, kind of European kind of museum privilege versus sort of those sort of elsewhere, sort of how they're very much kind of from Höch's perspective, I think, part of a common humanity. And she has this wonderful quote that I really like to use a lot. And I'm going to paraphrase it. I don't remember it exactly, but and this happened, I think, in the 70s or maybe it was earlier, where she sort of has this in one of her exhibition catalogs, that Hannah Höch said she likes to portray the world as another person sees it, or as a bee sees it, or some other thing sees it, because as a human, she's sort of bound where she is, and she uses her kind of her fantasy as a kind of bridge to sort of understand the lives and feelings of others and other things. And I think that's a really wonderful impulse we see in her work. And this was already, this series was from the 1920s, and it certainly kind of speaks to some of the things happening in Germany today, certainly the Humboldt Forum and the debates about, now, thank goodness, the Humboldt Forum stuff, I think, has generated a more robust discussion of Germany's colonial history. And I think there are some fantastic scholarship. I'm just reading a number of things. Tiffany Florville's work on mobilizing Black Germany, for example, just does a great job of talking about Germany's colonial history from the late 1800s into the 20th century, and that history, it's surprising how little that history had been talked about before in Germany, sort of being sort of quote unquote late to the colonial game. It was almost as if Germany never had colonies. So I think one of the benefits of something like the Humboldt Forum and the debates about repatriation of artifacts is that, wow, Germany is maybe now recognizing, and then the public, broadly speaking, is recognizing that there is a colonial history to reckon with within Germany as well.
Certainly. And my mind also came to that. as I was reading your text, thinking about contemporary debates and what these, issues can bring back to the surface that were sort of taken out of the narrative. And I think that I'm taking up much of your afternoon, so I want to bring us to a close. But before I do that, I wanted to hear what you're working on now, perhaps how this project has influenced or helped to spark the transition to your next project. I saw that you're working on a project entitled Internationalization Through Integration, Educational Reform in Creative Professions in the EU, China, and the USA. So this made me think about your interdisciplinary background, that you studied economics, international relations, art, literature. So it seems to also be incredibly diverse in the disciplines that you dip into. So if you could tell me a bit more about that and what's coming next, I'd be very appreciative.
Oh, happy to do that. Yeah, and that's, so what's happened with this project, I've got to say, teaching at an art college probably more than I expected really has influenced the kind of way I've approached some of the material and then thinking about how other lives it might have had. So I'm really quite interested in the way in which avant-garde practices in general are so how we talk about as art historians and visual culture scholars about how we talk about avant-gardism as a kind of European practice. And that may be surprising to some folks and like old hat to others who would listen to this. But one of the things it's made me do is look at Dada in general and what was happening both within the European versions of Dada. Someone like Tristan Tzara, who was a key figure, Samuel Rosenstock, who was a Romanian, a Jewish Romanian refugee, basically kind of hiding out in Zurich, Switzerland in the 1910s and helped kind of establish the Dada movement. Sort of his story within the European avant-garde as a kind of a marginalized figure, and maybe doubly marginalized in the sense as a refugee and then also as a kind of as a Jewish figure who was, like Friedlander, oftentimes not taken seriously by some of the other members of the Dada groups and the avant-garde circles, especially notoriously André Breton in France, in Paris, had a particular problem with Tristan Tzara. That's the stuff of Dada legend, as some of our folks will know. But I'm amazed about the way in which the kind of some of the Dada practices, which I don't think necessarily are inherently ontologically European in origin, have a larger global shelf life. I mean, Tzara, for his part, and Adrian Sudhalter has done fantastic work in this sense. Tzara had this ambition with Francis Picabia to publish what was going to be called the Dada Globe Project, and this was already taking form in the 1910s into the 1920s, in which they were going to solicit Dada statements from artists and figures across the globe. And their idea of the globe may have been more limited than you or I think, Leah, but that was the ambition. It was going to be a transnational kind of project. And Adrian Sudhalter, it was never published, but Adrian Sudhalter working with the Met, I think she was working with the Met when this happened in 2016, and Sarah's estate, who was really, really generous, that they were able to publish the Dada Globe Project and what was compiled, what was going to be that compendium. So that came out actually 100 years after the origins of European Dada in 2016. But then, seeing that there were many other iterations of what we kind of refer to as the Dada, the critical Dada practice, or Dada as this critical art movement, one of the texts I've been working on is about Dada in South Africa. And they have some wonderful colleagues that have worked on an exhibition in South Africa, some artists who were using Dada strategies and tactics as an anti-apartheid critique already even in the 1960s, but more presently in the 1990s, in 1980s, 1990s, and sort of kind of focusing on Dada kind of as a critical avant-garde practice in South Africa, but also Dada in China in 1984, 85, 86. There was a in Xiamen, Dada, Xiamen, China, a Dada movement under Huan Yongping, the Chinese artist who immigrated to Paris and just recently passed away in October of 2019. And there's a Black Dada iteration as well, you know, Adam Pendleton today is in Brooklyn based, still active and doing kind of this Black Dada project, which has its roots, interestingly enough, in the Black arts movement here in California, in Oakland, and the Black Panther, the Black Power movement, with someone like Everett Leroy Jones, who also is known as Amiri Baraka. So I've sort of become very interested in you know, kind of the way in which avant-garde practices broadly are, might be recast as not necessarily, you know, framed only as European origin stories, but trying to think through these other iterations and how do we talk about Black Dada and Shaman Dada and Dada in South Africa, and sort of the transatlantic, the transnational, the global dimensions of this critical practice that that I think some of our Berlin Dada friends were engaging in the 1910s and 1920s.
Well, that's very exciting. I'm looking forward to reading about that. Yeah. And I thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me about your new book. And I hope that many others will have the pleasure of reading it as well now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Leah. It's been really, really a joy for me.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Okay. Bye-bye.